Hello, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and I'm excited to have on the line with me today Dr. Dan Garvey, who is the president of Prescott College, which is an experientially based liberal arts college. He's the formerly a faculty member at the University of New Hampshire, where he taught and researched in the area of experiential education. He is the former president and executive director of the Association for Experiential Education. He's a recipient of the 1997 Kurt Hahn Award. Dan has authored more than 25 books and articles dealing with the broad topic of experiential education. And he has also sailed around the world three times as the Dean of Semester at Sea Program with the University of Pittsburgh. Dan, I'd like to welcome you to the call.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to talk to you.
Well, I'd like to start off with this question, which is, why do we do experiential education at all? This whole idea of adventure education, experiential education, what is going on with it, and why is it so important?
Oh, that's a great question, and I'm sure as we continue our conversation, we'll probably deconstruct this question at many levels, but it really is all about the larger question about how do we learn. I mean, how is it that we learn anything in the world? And I suppose we could look at it from a historical perspective. The most efficient way that we used to learn everything was through the apprentice process. So if someone wanted to learn how to, make swords, they would become an apprentice, and they would actually work with the blacksmith, and they would figure out how to do it. If someone wanted to learn how to do almost anything, they would apprentice. Over time, as our cultures became more and more complex, and it became more necessary for us to teach large numbers of people repetitive tasks, we started to substitute pedagogy and more formal pedagogy because it was just more efficient. It would really be better, if you can imagine moving from an agrarian society to an industrialized society, it really would be better if you had the time to sit down with every individual and teach them how to use that lathe or how to make those shoes, but you don't. So you have to count on the fact that you have a culture of people who have been trained to take orders in symbolic ways where they don't need to have personal involvement with the subject matter until some later date. So you start with an education. You eventually develop an educational system that substitutes the approximation of knowledge and the acquisition of facts for actual hands-on and direct contact with that same corpus of information. So my initial response to your question, why do we do it, is we do it because we've always done it, and if we had a chance to do this, we would probably use experiential education to transmit almost everything. Certainly, our own interactions with our own children, we tend to try to get them involved in really important issues in their lives rather than do it in a theoretical sense.
So people who are listening to this call are interested in teaching and learning.
Yep.
And so are you saying that you just said that we would teach almost everything experientially?
Yeah.
So why don't we don't do that now? I mean, if you go to the average public school classroom, it's pretty much an instructor standing in front of the room with people sitting in chairs listening passively.
Right.
And so how did we end up down that road where it what you're saying is in complete contrast to what is going on every day all over the country?
Sure. And this conversation that we have will be mildly controversial, and I suspect that there will be listeners who will want to take issue with many of the things that you and I are going to pass over, and that's great. I mean, there's nothing better than that. Certainly, it's a waste of time to be listening to someone who's saying exactly what you think because you've already thought it. But in fact, when you think of it, any time the consequences of knowing or not knowing have a really strong negative outcome within our culture,
mm-hmm.
we do have experiential components then.
Give me an example.
For example, we have internships for doctors. We make sure that engineers have had practical experience in bridge construction. Every time the outcome of not learning could be disastrous,
yeah.
our culture has maintained that there has to be experiential education in the curriculum. Because people don't die from dangling modifiers or from not being able to parse a sentence, we don't have experiential components in every English curriculum necessarily, although most good teachers do. But any time that the culture believes intuitively or experientially that the learner must actually know this stuff, there's always an experiential component to it. When we don't know or care, because there's no ultimate disaster that can befall that corpus of information, then we can go blithely along with the pedagogy that you're talking about, where someone comes in and just lectures. One of the interesting things, Tom, years ago I taught philosophy of experiential education at the University of Colorado, and my recollection, this was a long time ago, but my recollection was that I had mostly master's students, if not all master's and doctoral students, in the class. I remember going in, and I taught that course for one or two semesters with under the direction of Dick Kraft, who's a faculty emeritus there. And I remember saying to my class that at the beginning of the semester that I would give an A to any graduate student who was able to find research that supported the idea that a teacher should come into class with prepared notes and lecture. All they had to do was find articles that supported that as an effective teaching methodology, and I would give them an A that day, and they wouldn't have to come to class for the rest of the semester. That was a fairly outrageous challenge,
yeah.
but I felt fairly confident. And in fact, in 2 years of running that class, I never had someone who came in now and had any justification that was supported by research to support this approach. Think about that. We have scads of research on open classrooms, on peer learning, on experiential education, on pretty much everything else in education has been thoroughly researched. I couldn't find, and maybe some of our listeners can send it to me, I couldn't find any articles that supported the idea that, you know, that sort of went at this thesis. If you really want to be effective as a teacher, you get yourself some notes, put them on index cards, make sure you highlight them, walk into class, and I'm telling you, you're going to be an effective teacher. Mm. I don't find any articles that would support that. And yet, that's what most of us did, and some of us still do.
Yes. Now, so how do we get from that this idea that pretty much everybody, if they're challenged and they do the research, they will come up to with the same conclusion that you just did, which is experiential learning is just more effective.
Yes.
How do we get from that to the practical application, which is what's going on, you know, today in a classroom?
Absolutely.
You know, I walk there. Or let's say that there's a trainer with some corporation listening to this. It's surprising to me how many trainers will pretty much just repeat what they've experienced in the classroom. You know,
sure.
Most people think, well, I know what education is because I've been through however many years, you know, grade school and then college and some master's program, and much of it is the same thing. And so then they find themselves in a position of teaching or training, and they just repeat the process.
Well, first of all, if you looked at education across different cultures and over time, I think most educational theorists, and you probably remember this even from your own training, eventually face one critical reality, and that is that education always follows society. It doesn't lead society.
Hmm.
So the education that you have, whatever that is erected to support the societal needs and culture of that particular culture within which it's embedded. We who are educators oftentimes think that we are on the vanguard and the cutting edge because some of the things that are discussed in education, particularly higher education, are controversial. But the actual way that education is delivered always supports the culture. So, in other words, you go to India, you don't find an educational system that doesn't some way support the caste system. Mm. I did a lot of work in the former Soviet Union. You don't find an educational system before the breakup of the Soviet Union that didn't support the notion of communism. In the United States, we developed an education system that supported what we needed, and what we needed was large numbers of people who could sit and be trained to do work, to pick up bits of information that may or may not be connected one to the other, but people could understand these discrete pieces of information, because that's what a society that was moving from basically an agrarian society to an industrialized society needed. We don't have to go back very far to realize that the learning methods that a farmer would need in order for the farmer to be successful are very different from what the learning needs would be of someone who is going to be working in Lowell or Lawrence, Massachusetts, making shoes, for instance. So our society developed the pedagogy that we have because it fit. And then there's a phrase in sociology that you become what you behold. If you see this, and this is called education, and this is called education for multiple generations, eventually the whole society believes this is education. Mm. I mean, one of the funniest things of all is I don't think there certainly is no pediatrician. There's no one that thinks about the bodily functions of people that would conclude that it really makes a whole lot of sense to have children in 45-minute periods or hour-long periods where they can't go to the bathroom, or it's difficult for them to do that, yeah. Or to erect a system that had teenagers, because of their biological clocks, waking up and going to class at 7 o'clock in the morning. It just doesn't work, unless you realize that, wait a minute, it does work if you want 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds to be able to report to work. Then it works. So anyway, this is a long way around the barn, and it is a little bit, it would take more than our interview time to kind of document this, but I feel fairly confident that our system and what we value in education is rooted in what we value in the culture, and that is sort of passive learners.
So you say that education follows the culture. So,
right.
So in order to change education, that's going to happen because the culture changes?
Well, that's a very sophisticated question. So then you have to ask yourself the question, okay, well, where do you apply the pressure?
Right.
Can you possibly change the culture, and then that will change education, logically? Or can you start doing something with education that will encourage the evolution of the culture? Mm-hmm. And I think that you and I are convinced that we have the potential to change the culture by trying to do something with the educational system. So we've both chosen... maybe because we just don't want to take on the whole entire culture as our first move, but we've both chosen to try to see if we can do something with education that will have a carryover. And I think there's a reasonable chance that could have a profound ripple effect in the larger culture.
So an educator is listening to this, a trainer. What is controversial about experiential education? Why isn't it just get taken up and people say, you know, plant their flag and say, this is it. We've discovered that, you know, we must head down this pathway of experiential learning.
Well, one thing is because it's messy.
What do you mean by that?
Well, once you decide that the teacher, trainer, whomever, is the creator of experiences, but they once they have designed something, then the learner takes control. It can be loud, and it can be messy, and it can look unorganized.
Do you have an example of where a shift like that was made from someone who was going traditionally and then said, let's try this, experiential?
Yeah, actually, every one of us has examples. We can think of the teacher in our school that had students deeply involved in projects instead of sitting in rows. Mm-hmm. And we know as we walk down the corridor that class, there was a cacophony of sound. People were going crazy. Kids were, you know, talking to each other. It seemed from the outside that there was chaos. And that, I think, is something that is really hard for people to appreciate, that in that chaos, that true learning can occur. And that goes back to this sort of a priori notion of what education looks like. So I would say that there are multiple reasons why we support what I would call the orthodox consensus, which is the more traditional approach. One is because it serves the society. Another one, it's more orderly. Another one is that probably we as educators want to support it because it puts us in a position of leadership, control, power that isn't there when you're an experiential educator oftentimes. Mm. And ultimately, it will tie back in to testing in a more direct way. If you know that you're going to be tested on low-level sort of learning outcomes on your ability to regurgitate, then the orthodox consensus is a better way to do it.
Really?
Sure. I mean, I think you and I could probably help people learn the elements of the periodic table quicker by drilling them than by having them experience.
Mm.
Now, if you stop right there, then the traditional education is really a better buy. But if you have to then say, okay, well, why would one want to learn about the elements in the periodic table? Then you'd have to say, well, maybe experiential ed has something to offer because eventually people might want to be using some of these elements or at least understanding their interaction one to the other.
Mm. I want to ask you a question about the experiential educator themselves, because here is my experience in getting a teaching degree and then going straight from that to working in a experiential wilderness-based adventure learning program. I had some problems in how I thought learning would work. And I don't know if I'm making sense here, but I had to make some big steps and jumps. And I'm wondering if you can...
Like for what? Give us an example.
Well, for example, when I was working in this program, this was a program serving adjudicated youth.
Sure.
Okay, so most of whom, virtually all, we had an opportunity to look at their school records and whatnot, and most of them did terribly in school.
Sure.
And so I went in thinking, well, these must be dumb kids. That was pure judgment.
And, right.
And what I came to find out was that, no, they were brilliant. And so I thought, well, how is it possible that they could do so well mapping compass or this, you know, working in an outdoor experiential environment, but you put them in a classroom and they just suffer? What's going on there? And so what I thought I understood about learning and teaching was not, well, I had to make some jumps. And so I'm wondering if you can share your insights as what are the unique demands of an experiential educator? If someone says, well, I'd like to teach more experientially, what will be demanded of them?
Well, it's It's not either or in the way that you've sort of set this up.
Okay.
Dewey, first of all, I would encourage people to go back to John Dewey and read Experience in Education.
Okay.
And it's a very small book, about 100 pages, but it's incredibly dense. Unbelievably dense, but it sort of is the roadmap for experiential educators, in my opinion. If one decides, if you wake up tomorrow and you say, you know what, I really want to be an experiential educator, I think the thing that the most important distinction you're making is that you are going to try to help the learner learn in whatever modality that person finds most efficient. So in the example that you gave about the adjudicated youth, there are, and I've had that experience myself working in prisons and treatment centers, etc., there are kids for whom experiential education is going to be an epiphany.
Mm.
This is going to be the first time that they've succeeded. However, there will be other kids who still learn better in a more traditional way. They like the structure. An experiential educator, I don't think, if you're serious about it, has the luxury of substituting activity for another kind of pedagogical approach. What the experiential educator has to do is that he or she has to decide that they are going to really drill down as deeply as they can to the learning preferences of each student and allow that student to find ways of capturing the information using whatever method is most important for them. That's one of the reasons why I think Gardner's work on modes of learning,
yes,
had such a great impact on the educational structure in the country, because most teachers, most of us that are involved in education, knew he was right. We've known it for a long time that no single methodology is going to work for all students. However, if one is an experiential educator and you accept that, then the medium within which you're delivering your lessons or, you know, working the education is open to the possibility that someone could have an individualized learning experience. It's not shut. And I think that's the most important thing. So the unsophisticated, young, experiential educator, in my mind, wants to substitute open, free, and non-directed for sort of a more pedantic approach. As someone stays as an experiential educator longer, I think what they realize is that I'm at my best when I have no preconceived notion of who this person or who this group is, and I try my best to encourage them to tell me how they want me to help them learn the material.
And is this what sets an experiential educator apart? I mean, as president of AEE, Association for Experiential Education, is that what really sets an experiential educator apart from all the other approaches of education?
Yeah, if it's done correctly. You know, I know that I'm talking to someone who has a pretty sophisticated understanding, so I'm going to indulge that for a second. Here's an example, Tom. A good experiential educator, let's say a van is arriving at an outdoor education center, and in that van are 12 seventh graders.
Okay.
We fall into the same problems, or let's say there were 12 executives from a company.
Mm-hmm.
The good experiential educator understands that that is not a coherent group of people who are going to be getting the same program, that there are individuals there. The less effective experiential educator sees them as corporate people or seventh graders. How does that play out? The less effective experiential educator takes that group of seventh graders and says to themselves, oh, I know how to work with junior high school kids, and they put them through a series of activities that are the same sequence and the same activities that they used the day before with high school kids, and they're the same ones they're going to use the day after with some other group, they're going to try to process it basically the same way. They're going to ask the same kinds of questions. They're going to use the same elements in the same order. They're going to have lunch at the same time, on and on and on. And when that group of seventh graders gets back on the van,
right,
they're all singing and happy, and the educator believes that they gave them a really valid experience. And what I would say is they gave them what I call splash and giggle. This was fun, but was it the best possible? No. The experiential, the good experiential educator, if we could kind of contrast that,
yes,
greets that group of seventh graders and is somehow aware that this group is different than the group that came before. In fact, it's different than another group of seventh graders that could be arriving on the same day. And so I've got to figure out how can the information that's coming out from this group be used to supplement and complement the activities and the way that I process those activities as the day goes along. So you are a good experiential educator, I think, is exhausted because they are constantly trying to make sure that they've chosen the right activities and that those activities are geared to the real emerging needs of the group and individuals as they present themselves.
And to get to that level, you've worked with a lot of students who are on that path.
Sure.
And what are the shifts that you see that happen? What's required of that person to become a good experiential educator, to make the shift from beginner to expert? What's in other words, is it a personal development piece?
Yes, I think there's all of that. I think it's experience. It's what you consider to be success. It's how you see yourself. I think there was I apologize to the listeners, but there was a book called The Tao of Teaching that started from the premise that good teachers basically have to deal with their own ego. And despite my pontification during this interview, which could sound like it's pretty ego-driven, I think good experiential educators are trying to give up control and power in their classroom to their learners constantly. And I think for most of us, and I don't know if you had this experience, Tom, it's pretty flippant seductive. I mean, it's pretty seductive.
To be in control.
You bet your life. I mean, they come in and they're, you know, Mr. Garvey and, you know, and blah, 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 or Professor Garvey. You know, it's very interesting how seductive that can be. And so the evolution is that you have to get your satisfaction out of a very indirect recognition that the learner, as they leave your experience, is typically saying to themselves, boy, I learned a lot, and oh yeah, the teacher was there too, but they don't really make the connection oftentimes that you were the person who helped create these experiences or allow these experiences to happen. The learner believes that they are the ones who constructed this, which is wonderful, of course, because that's the long term. So there are multiple layers, and you know, obviously.
Can you help me understand a realization, which is the traditional education, classroom educator, one of the things that's supposed to be able to happen is that if you teach this curriculum in this way over this period of time, that you will get this outcome.
Sure. Now than ever, too,
right,
as you know.
And even if halfway through the school year, you take out teacher A because she got sick or something, and teacher B comes in, and if they're certified in the same thing, then everything should just roll along, sort of like a production, you know, at a making a car.
Yes.
And yet, one of the things that I remember a study done a number of years ago, that one of the biggest fears of teachers, instructors, is losing control. And what you're suggesting is it flies in the face of that very thing, is that if someone heads down this path, you're asking these questions and you're continually searching for what's the right path and looking for what's coming out of the group, you start the day, but you don't necessarily know where you're going to end up.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely correct.
And that fear, that can cause a lot of fear.
Of course it does. I mean, yes, because you're, the example I have used, I mean, you're absolutely right, Tom. The example I have used, and I taught an ethics class as a guest lecturer last week, and I did exactly what you're saying. I went to the board and I put on the board point A, and then I put on the board, you know, about 3 feet away, point B. And I said, we are at point A. We're starting this class. And in 3 hours, we're going to be at point B. And you think that I know that there's a line between point A and point B? And I'm here to tell you, I have no idea what is going to happen between point A and point B. All I know is that in time, as we're together, we will get to B, and we need to celebrate whatever B is. But I don't know what that is yet, and neither do you.
Mm.
So if you're sitting here waiting for me to take you from A to B, you're going to be woefully, you're going to be profoundly disappointed because I don't have B in mind. I only have A. Here's where we are.
Wow. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time together here, and I'd like to perhaps close on.
Sure.
What is it? What comes up in this conversation for me is that in order to be a highly effective experiential educator, is that you've got to have a lot of trust. And so, if that's true, and perhaps it's not, I'm curious, what is it that you trust in? What is it when you go to work with a group? What are some of the things that you know and believe and you trust in?
Well, maybe I'm hitting you off at the pass, but tell me, and we can reframe this.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, I've done teacher training programs for consultants for 35 years. And I think the question oftentimes, in addition to trust, is, okay, how do I do it? How do I get from where I am as this kind of teacher to this other kind of teacher?
Mm-hmm.
And I think your question about trust is a really good one, Tom. My recommendation would be that someone try doing a little bit of this. So if you're a regular classroom teacher, decide that you're going to make a commitment that Tuesdays you're an experiential educator. Don't do Monday through Friday and expect it to work, because it's not going to work. It's like someone who starts an exercise program and decides that they're going to now start running a marathon every day and doing 100 sit-ups. It ain't going to happen.
Mm.
But if you commit to one small thing, this discrete time that you're going to try something different, the trust will flow, because the outcome, I feel absolutely certain, will be self-reinforcing. You will be encouraged to continue on that path, because you are going to have more authentic and more powerful relationships as a teacher than you've ever had before, or trainer. So you can't go from where you are being the master of your PowerPoint or the overheads or whatever it is,
right,
to this place where people are really having true dialogue. You can't do that in one jump, but you can take small steps, and every step, I believe, will be an opportunity for reinforcement.
I love what you said, the authentic. I think that that's one of the other things that experiential education has required of me, is the more authentic I become, the more effective I become.
Sure.
Yeah. So how do our listeners find out more, or do you have, can you recommend some books that if they say, gosh, I want to learn more what Dan
sure.
Garvey has to say, where do they start?
Well, the easiest thing probably would be to go to the Association for Experiential Education, AEE, in Boulder, Colorado. They have a whole list of publications that you can, you know, kind of delve into. In addition to that, they publish the Journal of Experiential Education, and I find that to be a really, really interesting document that comes out. So I would start with AEE, and then if people want to get in touch with me personally, they can just get in touch with me at the college at dgarvey@prescott.edu. dgarvey@prescott.edu. And I do the best I can to answer emails and work with people on an individual basis.
Yes. And so what is up on the horizon for you in addition to your work at the college? Is there anything that you're working on?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. Yeah, the thing that gets me excited about experiential education these days is the impact we're having on people's sense of justice.
Mm.
I've been doing a fair amount of research. In fact, there's a new article I just had published with a colleague, Jordana DeSeo Spencer, on the effects of experiential education on moving sort of the moral reasoning of participants in a positive direction. And so I'm starting to see that this experiential ed approach is not only powerful for the acquisition of information and subjects, but it has a associated positive impact on people's ability to make sense out of really difficult moral dilemmas that they have in their life, because the same skills that you learn to master knowledge are used cognitively to master dilemmas in our lives that are sometimes confounding.
What will be the result of this research?
Well, the result will be that parents will wake up and they'll say, you know what? Not only do I want my kid to learn about the periodic table, but I want them to be just, reasonable, compassionate, and ethical individuals. And therefore, I better find a teacher that uses experiential techniques, because that seems to be the best way to do it.
Wow. And will you be sharing what you're doing through a book? Or
eventually, but right now, it's just this article I'm talking about, and there are some others. You can get that through AEE, but there's a new journal on therapeutic schools and programs. It's a brand new referee journal that just came out. Journal of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, and that article's in that.
Fantastic. Well, Dan, you've been a delight to talk with, and I encourage all our listeners to go out and learn more and go to AEE, the website. I'll have a link next to this recording so that people can go straight there.
Well, thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
Yes. Well, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and I've been talking with Dr. Dan Garvey, of president of Prescott College, and encourage you to find as much as you can about what Dan's talking about, this idea of experiential education. You can find more at AEE. And so thank you, Dan, and thank you for our listeners, and look forward to another conversation. Bye-bye.